This is HPR episode 1707 entitled, A Tour Round My Desktop. It is hosted by Biza and is about 47 minutes long. The summary is, a look at the applications I use, why I use them and the alternatives I've tried.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi, I'm Biza, and this is my third podcast for HPR. In my first, I talked about how I came to be a Linux user. In my second episode, I was making the point that one of the main features of Linux is that of choice, but a lot of us still tend to choose our applications from a relatively small subset of the many that are available to us. My plea was that we owe it to the developers who give up a lot of their time on our behalf to give their applications a try rather than simply opting straight away for what everybody else is using. The subject of this episode, in a way, sits between the other two. I'm going to do a tour of my desktop and highlight some of the applications I use and explain why I use them. I accept that this does have the potential to bore people rigid, but on the other hand, it might just give a few tips to somebody who's not entirely happy with what they're using at the moment. I'll better start by telling what computer I'm using. Well, I've got four altogether. The one I use mostly is a Dell laptop that's got, I think, a 17-inch monitor. Or whatever size it is, it's certainly the biggest laptop screen I could find. As well as the Dell, I've got an HP laptop, which, strictly speaking, belongs to my daughter. But she's sort of lost interest in it now she's got an iPad, so I use it if my missus is using the Dell. I've got an Acer laptop with about a 12-inch screen, which I only really use if I'm travelling. These days I work mainly from home, so it doesn't see the light of day very often, but in the past it's been with me all over Europe and America and got some rough treatment along the way, but it's never let me down. Finally, there's the Acer netbook, which is just used as a media centre in my living room. With a 10-inch screen, it's not much use for productive work, but for playing music and video, it's fantastic. If I want to watch a DVD, I generally rip it to a video file on the Dell and then copy it across to the netbook. If it's a spur-of-the-moment thing, though, I can always just connect an external DVD drive to it. The quality of audio that comes out of the headphone jack is incredible. I just feed that into my hi-fi amplifier and I've got an audio system that sounds every bit as good as anything I've ever had. I feed the video signal from the netbook into my TV using a VGA cable. The netbook does have an HDMI output as well, but in all honesty, I think that the image quality through VGA is better. The only limiting factor of using a netbook as a media player, instead of something with a bit more power, is that a graphics card won't support anything with a resolution above 720p. What I do on the few occasions that I've had a bit of 1080 video to watch is I just run it from my Raspberry Pi. I found that if you play video on the Pi using a desktop-style distro like Raspbian, at higher resolutions it gets a bit jerky. However, if you use a dedicated media distro like OpenELEC, which is a single-task distro designed to run XBMC, the video playback is perfect even at 1080. Another thing I could do with the netbook is use it to play internet radio through my amplifier. In my view, the standard of commercial radio in the UK is generally abysmal. There are one or two exceptions, but in the main they have pitiful playlists and they seem to employ morons as presenters who've got nothing worth saying, but they still insist on saying it. In my radio utopia, the DJs would all be like Clint Eastwood was in the film Play Misty For Me. I speak a bit of German and French, and I find the choice of music stations those countries offer is a considerable improvement. Better still, though, would be some of the American classic rock stations, but unfortunately a lot of their live streams block offshore IP addresses. I've tried using proxies, but with my slow broadband connection, they spend most of the time buffering. Overall, using a netbook as a media player, I reckon I'll get most of the functionality of a Sonos system, plus video, for a fraction of the cost. Until November 2014, I used to run Point Linux on all these machines. It's a Russian Debian derivative, and I found it absolutely unbreakable. But unfortunately, my printer gave up the ghost around end of October, and the one I bought to replace it just wouldn't work with the kernel which comes with Point Linux. I tried updating HP Lip to the latest version, which supposedly will support my new printer, but it still made no difference. I've not lost faith in Point Linux, and I'm sure the next version will use a kernel which enables me to use my printer. But for now, I've replaced it on three of my computers with Linux Mint 17, which has since been updated to 17.1. But my travelling laptop is never used for printing or scanning, so I've left that one alone. So what about desktop managers? Well, when I first moved to Linux, I just had a compact desktop machine that had 256 megs of memory. But my first distro was Ubuntu, which used GNOME 2. It worked okay, but as I got more into Linux, I heard about XFCE, which was supposedly better suited to lower-powered kit. As a result, I gave Ubuntu a try, and it certainly was a bit quicker to load, and overall a bit more responsive than GNOME. And in that respect, it was a definite improvement, but the default appearance of XFCE out the box at that time was bloody awful. It's better now, but I still think there's a way to go. When you see what some distros managed to achieve with XFCE, you realise how conservative the developers seem to be. I really think they undersell what is actually a very good desktop manager. Fortunately, XFCE comes with quite a lot of alternative themes, so I found one that I could live with and stayed with it. Since then, I've tried other desktop managers, but I keep coming back to XFCE. When Unity came out, I ran it from a live Ubuntu CD and stayed with it for all of 15 minutes. I really couldn't see how anybody could consider it an improvement over GNOME 2. Unity has supposedly improved a lot over the last year or two, and I have given it another try. But it doesn't look any better to me, so that's it as far as I'm concerned. I've tried GNOME 3, but that's got much the same issues as Unity from my point of view. Its concept is equally at odds with the way I like to interact with my computers. KDE is very different to Unity in GNOME 3, and visually it's very impressive, but I still have trouble understanding where they're coming from. The standard desktop on Point Linux is Mate, which, as I'm sure everybody knows, is a reinvention of GNOME 2. It's not bad at all, but when I first installed Point Linux, there were only a few themes available for it, none of which were anything special. Consequently, I soon installed XFCE and stuck with that until my move to Linux Mint. At this point, can I make a plea to application developers to pick sensible names for their software? There's nothing wrong with the word mate, spelled M-A-T-E, and there's nothing wrong with the word mate, if that's what you want to call it, but for God's sake, choose an unambiguous spelling. Otherwise, you end up with a ridiculous situation where every discussion is invariably prefaced with the mate or mate confusion. When I migrated to Mint, on my two main laptops, I opted for Cinnamon, but I knew the netbook probably isn't up to it, with only 1 gig of memory and an Atom processor, so I went straight to XFCE for that machine. On my Dell, though, I stayed with Cinnamon for maybe a month or so, but once the novelty wore off, I inevitably ended up installing XFCE, and that's what I use now. But fortunately, some of the GTK3 themes which come with Cinnamon also work to some extent with XFCE, so you benefit from a lot more icon sets and colour schemes than you get with stock XFCE. So that's my desktop choice. So the next issue is what I use my computers for. Well, I've already described how I use the netbook as a media player, but what about the main Dell? Well, this is the centre of my computing world, as I often spend all day sat in front of it. For the most part, I'm writing documents or emails, sometimes entering stuff into spreadsheets, and when the need arises, I do a bit of programming, which tends to be in intense bursts every few weeks rather than as a daily task. Most of the time, I like to have music or speech playing in the background, often internet radio. I'm a bit of a musician on the side, so I do quite a lot of audio editing, generally stuff I've recorded on my Zoom H2. Over the last couple of years, I've been making a concerted effort to scan my family photos for safekeeping. There's thousands of them going back 80 or 90 years in some cases, but not only does it take time to scan each image, it then has to be processed to take care of any fading or damage, and this means I spend quite a bit of time using graphic software. Right, let's start looking at the applications. I'll do this by working my way up the XFCE menu. I won't dwell much on general utilities which come as standard with the distro, unless they play an important role in the way I use a computer. Now, because I installed XFCE alongside Cinnamon, I have some tools from both sides of the fence, and most of these will run perfectly well with either window manager. For example, the Nemo file manager works fine with XFCE, but I prefer Tunar simply because it's faster, especially when you view folders containing a large number of items. Starting with the system menu, the first item I see which I installed myself is UNet booting. For testing out distros in live mode, what I always do is download the ISO, then use UNet booting to write it to a USB memory stick or even an SD card. I've listened to podcasts where people testing out distros have complained that UNet booting wouldn't work with their ISO or the computer wouldn't boot from it afterwards. Well, I have to say, that's not a problem I've ever encountered. For me, booting from a memory stick or SD is so much faster than from a CD that I wouldn't consider any other approach. Also on the system menu, I have VirtualBox. I've got a few Windows applications which I use very occasionally, but certainly not enough to justify dual booting, so using a Windows XP virtual machine is the ideal option for me. I've tried using Wine, but it involves too many functional compromises for my liking. But with a virtual machine, I know that everything will work properly. Also, if I bugger anything up, I can easily revert to a backup of the VM. What I use Windows for is mainly running an old copy of Microsoft Flight Simulator, and there are also a couple of specialist applications which my missus uses for her work. A great thing about VirtualBox is that although the VM is completely self-contained, you can also map the Linux file system to a Windows drive letter, as if it were a network drive, so you can access all your usual data from a Windows application if you need to. I've never really tried any other desktop virtualization tools. I found VirtualBox so easy to use from word go. The only problem I've ever really encountered is that of setting a VM up to recognise some USB devices, like the joystick I use with Flight Simulator. That always seems to be a little more complicated than it needs to be. But if you just want to use Windows applications with a keyboard and mouse, I really wouldn't consider looking at anything else. There's nothing else of particular note in the system menu, so now it's on to the Office menu. The main feature on this is LibreOffice, which I'm sure everybody is familiar with. Apart from Base, the database tool, I think it's excellent. I'm a heavy user of it, but not a power user in terms of hammering every feature it provides. But I use Writer all the time and Calc quite a bit as well. Draw comes in handy from time to time, but I find that the drawing features within Writer are good enough for most things I need to do, like creating flowcharts and simple schematics. The best thing about Draw is that it saves everything you need as vector graphics, so you can expand objects as much as you like without losing definition or getting jagged lines on the diagonals. As far as I can tell, all the graphics capability within Writer is the same functionality as you find in Draw, so there is a considerable measure of overlap there. I almost never have to create presentations these days, but I used to in the past. I found that Impress pretty much did everything that PowerPoint does, but Base just doesn't do it for me, I'm afraid. The database itself is slow compared to just about every other tool I've used. The form design is archaic, and the programming language you use to create any decent functionality is quite long-winded. It's a variant of BASIC, which is, in principle, I'm very much in favour of, but the implementation, compared to Visual Basic, is very torturous. It will take a massive amount of work to ever become a competitor to Microsoft Access, and I can't see that ever happening. But I do have another solution to that problem, but I'll come to that a bit more later on. For all my documents, I just save them to the default ODT format. If I need to send a document to anybody which they just need to read, not update, then I'll save it as a PDF and using the button on the main toolbar, and that's a very handy facility. But if I'm sending a document to a Microsoft user that they may need to update, then I save it as DOC, as that is a completely stable format now. I'm told that DOCX is still evolving, so long-term compatibility might be more of an issue there. The same principle applies to the spreadsheet formats. For my own use, I just save to the default ODS format, but if I'm sending something to a Microsoft user, then I use XLS instead of XLSX. Whenever I import the document in a Microsoft format, for the sort of stuff I deal with, there really aren't any problems opening either DOC or DOCX. I can imagine there might be issues with highly complex layouts, though, where you've got lots of embedded objects and graphics, but that's not really something which affects me. Here's a tip. If you ever need to check the compatibility of a document you've created in LibreOffice or any other non-Microsoft application for that matter, open a Hotmail account and then upload the document into Word Online. In the event it needs any fine-tuning, do it there and it doesn't cost you any money. I've almost never used LibreOffice Math, but on the rare occasion when I've needed to insert a formula into a document, it's great. Because my main requirement is for word processing and spreadsheet functions, in principle I could use other applications instead. To that end, I gave AbbeyWord and Numeric quite a serious try. My conclusion was that Numeric is certainly a potential replacement for Calc for most users, whose need is just for standard spreadsheet functions, but AbbeyWord is a long way behind Writer. Apart from anything else, on all my machines there seems to be a bit of a lag between hitting a key and the text appearing on the screen. It's as if the keyboard buffer's not being read efficiently. So if you're not going to use AbbeyWord, the chances are you'll use LibreOffice or its OpenOffice cousin for your word processing needs. And in that case, you get Calc anyway, so running Numeric separately doesn't really make a lot of sense, unfortunately. One thing AbbeyWord is very good at, though, is document conversion. You can run it as a command line utility to convert almost anything to anything. LibreOffice can do this to some extent, but the syntax is awkward and there are a lot fewer format options. I once wrote an application to analyse documents for word occurrence statistics and it used AbbeyWord as a headless utility in the background to convert the input files to text before the parsing. Something else I've tried are a couple of proprietary Office applications which also run on Linux. These are SoftMaker Office, which is from Germany, and Kingsoft Office, which is Chinese. Now, they both have no-frills free versions, but these are free of charge, not free as in Richard Stallman. I have to say they both do a pretty decent job of word processing and spreadsheet work, but for anyone like me with a distrust for anything that's not open source, they're just not realistic propositions. The other thing I didn't like about both of them is that the user interface is clearly hard-coded so that your desktop theme is ignored. Another useful tool on my Office menu is PDF Shuffler. Now what this does is take one or more PDF documents and lets you add or remove pages or even copy pages from one to another so you can make an entirely new document. It's one of those applications I only use 3 or 4 times a year, but when I do use it, it really is invaluable. Moving now to my internet menu, I only use Firefox nowadays. I used to use Chrome for quite a long time, but then I started creating a few websites, and I was surprised at how poor the font rendering could be. Websites where I thought they were poorly designed, where the choice of fonts was concerned, actually had nothing wrong with them at all. It was a shortcoming with Chrome. One application on my internet menu I wouldn't be without is FileZilla. It's an FTP client which also supports secure FTP. Now, to use secure FTP, you need to have an SSH server installed and running on the remote end, and an SSH client at local end, but setting those up is trivial. I use FileZilla every day at some point to move files between my computers. It may be a DVD rip from my Dell to the netbook, or it may just be an instant safety backup of a document I'm working on. But it works equally well working with remote servers on the internet. Now look at the multimedia menu. Now here there's quite a few applications I've installed from choice. Starting at the top, I've got Audacity. Now for most people, it's the ubiquitous application if you're planning to record or edit the audio. But it isn't for me though. I find it slow, occasionally unstable, and more than anything else, complete overkill for what I need to do. My audio requirements are mainly cut and paste, fade in, fade out, and normalisation. For those basic operations, a much better application is MH WaveEdit. It can be expanded through plugins to apply all sorts of effects, but in its default configuration, it does everything I need it to do. This simplicity makes it very fast. You can open a 1 gig file in seconds and save it after editing in not a great deal longer. It can also record from any input source, including the sound card. So it comes in handy if you want to make a copy of an audio stream which you can't get access to directly. I only use Audacity for the few occasions when I need to remove background noise from an audio file. For this task, the noise fingerprint facility is very useful. What it does is subtract all the noise matching a selected clip from the selected area of the file. It came in very handy when I was making digital copies of all my old vinyl albums and some of the old Family 78s. It got rid of most of the surface noise to the extent that the digital copies actually end up much better on replay than the original records. One further thing I use Audacity for is converting Flash Player audio to MP3. I use Get iPlayer to download BBC radio programmes, but that runs fastest if you fetch the programs in their native Flash format rather than convert them on the fly to MP3. There are other applications which will make that conversion, but they all seem to introduce imperfections into the sound for some reason. Audacity, on the other hand, will convert it blemish-free. So for me, Audacity is certainly a useful tool to have around, but MH WaveEdit is the workhorse for my audio editing. For playing audio, though, I use Decibel. It really is a simple, no-nonsense player app, and it plays all the common formats and indexes the tracks by artist and album, but that's about it. There's no messing around with playing live network streams, acting as a Spotify or Last.fm client or anything like that. I've tried just about all the popular audio players like Banshee and Rhythmbox, and I even settled on Clementine for a while, but they all cloud the issue with the extra complexity, which I just didn't need. To tag audio files, I use the Audio Tag tool. The interface is cleaner than EasyTag, and to my eyes, it's a bit easier to use. To convert audio files, I generally use Sound Converter. Apart from not handling Flash audio very well, it converts everything else faultlessly. My main conversions are Wave to Org, Wave to MP3, and OGG to MP3, but unlike some converters, it can also create variable bitrate MP3s, which give you a high quality sound, but with a generally smaller file size, and that's great for cramming lots of music onto a 2 gig USB music player like the one I use. I tend to restrict VLC to video playback. There's really nothing better in my book, but the only place it doesn't work quite so well is on the netbook. If you play a video of around 720p, you work it on its limits, but for normal action it's still okay. However, if you get a burst of high speed action where the entire screen is changing rapidly, then it can get a bit blocky at times and even freeze for a second or two, so in short it gets overloaded. Now, because I played around with lots of video players before settling on VLC, I knew there were some less sophisticated ones which ought to have lower resource requirements. So I revisited those which weren't simply too awful to contemplate, as I'm afraid some of them are, and I found the solution is to use Parole. It's much lighter than VLC, but of course it gives you fewer options and control over the playback, but it's worth that compromise to be able to view those marginal videos. On my other computers though, for video playback it's VLC all the way. For DVD ripping, I only use Handbrake. It's excellent. You're a bit limited in the output format, but it hardly matters if you're going to be playing back the video on a Linux machine. I tried DVD rip for a while, but it was very slow and sometimes it wouldn't even read the disk properly. And when I was on Point Linux, the repositories didn't have Handbrake in them. So for the first time on Linux, I compiled an application from source. I followed all the instructions on the Handbrake website to letter, but it still kept throwing up compilation errors. And not having any other solutions, whenever the error showed a missing dependency or an invalid setting, I just edited the previous command to remove it and continued. Miraculously, I ended up with a working executable which I even managed to get running when I copied it to my other machines. But I'm sure it says something, but I'm just not sure quite what. But fortunately, Mint does have Handbrake in the repository, so with a bit of luck, I won't need to do that again. For editing video, I use OpenShot. Now, I read a fair bit of criticism of Linux video editors in general, and OpenShot in particular to some extent, but frankly, I can't understand why. I've used Windows Movie Maker in the past, and that was a lot harder to use. OpenShot has dozens of output options, so if I really need to rip a DVD to a video format not supported by Handbrake, I can just use one of the supported formats and then re-encode it afterwards with OpenShot. One final noteworthy application on my multimedia menu is Minitube. This is a viewer for YouTube videos which doesn't require Flash to be installed. It's really good. It used to have a download button, but I suspect the developers have had a bit of grief from the YouTube people about that. However, it still has a function to give you the full URL for the video, so you can save it via your browser or perhaps download it directly using wget. The advantage of Linux version is that it's free of charge. The Mac and Windows versions require payment before you can install it. Another advantage of Minitube is that it just fetches whatever video you select. There's no messing around with signing in to access certain categories of content. So whether it still works like that when YouTube introduces pay channels, I've got my doubts, but you never know. But in the meantime, it's definitely an application I'd recommend. From time to time, I have to create a DVD from a video file for someone who hasn't got a computer. I've tried a number of tools for this, and while they all work, some will only write direct to a disk, and some require you to create a menu or a welcome screen. If you just want to get the file onto the disk in a format that will play on a standard DVD player, I recommend an application called Bombono. It takes the video file, does all the necessary reformatting, and it creates an ISO file which can then be burnt to the DVD. Although it can write direct to the DVD if that's what you really want to do. Finally, my multimedia menu is the Spotify client. Now, I know this is closed source, but it's one of the few areas, along with Minitube, where I'm willing to turn a blind eye. I listen to an awful lot of music, so the £9.99 it costs me a month to be a premium member is money well spent. Compared to buying CDs or buying tracks through iTunes, it saves me a fortune. You can get the client from the Spotify website. They classify it as experimental software and it comes without any warranty. In its early days, it really wasn't up to much. It would play the music brilliantly, but any searches for artists and tracks would often crash the application. But over the last 6 months or so, it's improved enormously. It still looks exactly the same, but those crashes seem to be a thing of the past. When I used Clementine before settling on Decibel, it did claim to work as a Spotify client, but I found that its searches rarely returned all the relevant tracks. The big advantage of the native client over the browser-based Spotify player is that the client can play music at 320 kilobit resolution, whereas the web player is only, I think, 128. Also, it lets you download tracks for local storage to play offline. Now, these are downloaded using an algorithm which breaks up each track into small chunks with names which mean nothing to the human eye. That makes the tracks unplayable using anything other than the Spotify client. But what it does mean, though, is that if you're going away on holiday, for example, with no internet connection, you can plan ahead and download all the albums you think you may care to listen to while you're away. Next, we'll have a look at the graphics menu. At the top, I've got the DIA drawing application. I'll admit I don't use this an awful lot, but it's been very handy on the odd occasion. I suppose it's the Linux equivalent to Microsoft Visio. Its purpose is to draw all sorts of flowcharts, schematics, entity relation diagrams and so on. But most of my needs in this respect can be met by LibreOffice using Draw or the graphics tools built into Writer. But where Deer does win hands down, though, is if you need to produce a diagram using a specific formalised notation, as you might find in chemical engineering or something like that. It can export data in a large number of formats, so it should be able to interoperate with a lot of other tools as well. Moving down the submenu, we get to GIMP. I get the feeling this is one of those love more hate em applications. Personally, I think it's fantastic as it does everything I've ever wanted to do in terms of image manipulation. But on the other hand, I'm not a professional photographer or a graphic artist. What I can say, though, is that from what I see, people who start with GIMP seem to stay with it, and people who start with Photoshop are equally reluctant to change. Of course, when you spend several hundred pounds on Photoshop, then bravado may play a part, as nobody wants to admit afterwards that their needs could have been met by a free program. Rescuing or enhancing photos with GIMP can be very easy if you use some of the semi-automated tools like White Balance and Equalize. Other tools which work with colour saturation, contrast, brightness and so on cover most of my needs for photo enhancement, but I've used other tools to create images or apply effects to images for use in websites and documents. Well, they're not quite so easy to use, but then again, neither are they in Photoshop. The key to both these competing tools is knowing what you are trying to achieve and understanding the terminology. It's a complex area. No professional standard tool could be expected to do a decent job if it applies too many compromises just for the sake of some simplicity. Now, I've been told that Photoshop can do a few things which GIMP can't, and that's bound to be the case given that GIMP is not just a Photoshop clone. All I can say is that every visual effect I've ever attempted to create has been possible using GIMP on its own, even though it has sometimes taken a fair bit of research to find out how to do it. Just recently I heard about another graphics application called Critter. It got quite a few mentions on other Linux podcasts. I've installed it and had a brief play around with it, and it certainly addresses some of the same areas as GIMP with regard to image manipulation, but it strikes you as being aimed more at the person creating an image from scratch rather than modifying an image created by an external means like a camera. But so perhaps it's more for the artist than the photographer. Another drawing application I've got is Inkscape. Now that's one of those applications which impresses me a lot, but at the moment I don't really have the skill or the real need to use it in earnest, but I still love playing around with it. I think it can be said to overlap Critter and LibreOffice Draw that it makes it very easy to create and manipulate complex shapes and apply sophisticated lighting and shading effects and so on. With somebody designing logos or perhaps a computer artist, it's a tool which I think could probably provide with a lot of satisfaction. For scanning documents or photos, I use SimpleScan, which, as its name suggests, does all the donkey work for you. I've used it a hell of a lot over the years, and I've come to rely on it. But all the same, I've also installed Xane, or Zane, whatever it's supposed to be called. X-S-A-N-E. If you've got to scan something where you either want to ignore or specifically capture a subtle feature like a watermark, it gives you just that extra bit of control compared with Simple Scan. I can't say I like its user's interface very much, but it does a good job for all that. And like so many things, you can get used to its idiosyncrasies. Incidentally, when I was still on Point Linux and having trouble getting my new printer scanner to work, I played around with a number of scanning applications just in case the problem lay in that direction. Now, I discovered a package called Gscan to PDF, where the 2 is a number 2. I found that it would detect the new device as a scanner where nothing else would. So perhaps if you ever have scanner detection problems, give Gscan to PDF a try. Why it should recognise devices nothing else can see, I just don't know, but if it gets you out of trouble, you're not going to worry about that. I'm moving now to the education menu. There's only one item on there, and it's Stellarium. In case you've never heard of it, it's what you might call an interactive sky map or planetarium. if you've got even the remotest interest in astronomy, or even just get a bit curious about something you see in the night sky, you've just got to install Stellarium. You set your location and time, and it will reproduce exactly what you should be seeing in the sky at that moment. I've tested it at night against the real sky, and I can tell it's 100% accurate. In fact, it's better than that in a way, because it shows objects which are too dim for the naked eye and would otherwise require a telescope to view. You can zoom in on any part of the sky or an individual object and find out exactly what you're looking at. And Stellarium will tell you all about it, including its distance from the Earth. The display changes in real time in sync with the Earth's rotation. If you zoom in on Saturn, for example, it even displays the rings in the correct inclination as you'd see through a telescope. I know that because I've tried it. If you keep it updated, Stellarium will show transit objects such as comets that can also identify long-lasting artificial satellites as they pass overhead. I never stopped being impressed by Stellarium, and I'd recommend it to any thinking person with a computer, as it also runs on Windows and Mac. The last menu category I'm going to look at is the development menu. This is just two items on it, SQLite Manager and Gambus. We'll start with SQLite Manager. Now, this is a tool for managing SQLite databases, so it serves no purpose unless you install SQLite first. So the first question might be, what is SQLite? Well, it's a relational database engine which stores the entire database in a single file. Conceptually, it's the same as a Microsoft Access MDB file. You can copy it and email it to somebody else, and as long as they have SQLite installed, which can be on Linux, Mac, Windows or BSD, they can access and manipulate the data in exactly the same way as you can. You can even stick the file on a shared server and multiple users can access it. Not large numbers, mind you, but half a dozen or so shouldn't be a problem, as long as they're not retrieving records with large binary fields. The beauty of SQLite is that it scales brilliantly. The only effective size limit is determined by the constraints of your operating system, so tables containing millions of records are perfectly viable. SQLite Manager is an application which enables you to create and manage SQLite databases. You can define views and you can perform what few housekeeping tasks are required. For sheer simplicity and flexibility, it's nothing that comes close, whatever operating system you're using. Now, Gambus is my preferred development environment. Why it's not far more widely used defeats me, because in terms of power and ease of use, it beats everything else on Linux hands down. The Gambus is the closest you'll find to Visual Basic on Linux, but it's most definitely not just a VB clone. The people behind Gambus have gone to a lot of trouble to see what VB does well, but they also looked at where VB gets it wrong and put those things right. If you've ever developed an application in VB, you can use Gambus, but you'd have to get used to a few changes in the basic language syntax. But the way you design the form and attach code events is just about the same though. The Gambus libraries for just about everything you could possibly need. You can use them to create anything from a simple command line program to a highly complex multimedia application integrated with a website. You can connect to a SQLite database in four lines of code and any other kind of database in not much more. Alternatively, you can use bound controls where you define the database as a set of attributes with no code required at all. But at that point, if you use SQLite, what you have is something very close to the concept of access. You know, a user interface with bound controls talking to a database contained in a single file. All my business management tools have been developed this way. The first one took a bit of work to develop, but by reusing the code and forms, the rest have been a doddle to implement, less than a couple of hours in one case. I spent 20 years developing software using all sorts of programming languages like Fortran, C, C++, COBOL and VB, plus a few of the lesser known ones as well. It amuses me how people frown on BASIC as if it's some kind of noddy or hobbyist language. You can't call yourself a proper developer if you use BASIC, it seems. When you dig down, the most common complaint seems to be that the ability to use go-tos leads to amateurish spaghetti code. Well, I hate to disillusion all you basic haters, but just about every other programming language has a go-to facility, either with that exact keyword or something which has the same effect. Now, I've not used one single go-to in the last 12 years of using VB, Access and Gambus, but if you design and write good elegant code, you don't need go-tos. On the other hand, if you're a crap programmer, you can produce spaghetti code in C, Python or any other language you care to use. Another Linux development environment I tried is Lazarus. The way Gambus is clearly inspired by Visual Basic, Lazarus is inspired by Borl and Delphi. It has a WYSIWYG form designer, and you can define event handlers using a Pascal programming language. It's a lot more complicated to use than Gambus. In fact, the program structure and workflow reminds me more of using Visual C++. The big advantage Lazarus has over Gambus, though, is that it compiles to a native executable, while Gambus only creates an executable with an inescapable dependency and a runtime component. Also, Lazarus has Windows and Mac implementations which use identical coding syntax. This means that by copying the project files you created on Linux onto Windows, you can create a native Windows application with the same user interface and functionality without need to make any compatibility changes. That's a seriously useful feature for anyone developing an application for a wide-scale multi-platform deployment. I've no real plans to use Lazarus, other than for a bit of experimentation, but it's my contingency option if the Gambus project should ever close down. I hope that's never necessary, because Gambus fits my needs perfectly, and if you only need to run on Linux, it's far more productive than Lazarus is. But that doesn't alter the fact that Lazarus has a hell of a lot going for it. I was about to say that's it for my menus, but I've just remembered a brilliant utility I run from my accessories menu. That's Search Monkey. If you use Nemo, which is the standard file manager for Cinnamon, it includes a search facility which lets you track down files based on parts of their names. Thunar doesn't have a search facility, so you need a separate tool. Search Monkey also lets you search the contents of files for strings, and even Nemo doesn't do that. I imagine that Search Monkey is probably a front end for grep. Now that really is it for my menus. I also use one command line application a lot. That's Get iPlayer. This is an amazing utility which dips into the BBC library of radio and TV programmes and lets you download them to view at your convenience. I'm not a huge watcher of TV, but the BBC does produce some first-rate documentaries on science and on more general interest subjects as well. How useful Get iPlayer is to you depends on where in the world you are. As far as I can tell, you can only access TV programmes if your IP address links you to the UK. But I've managed to access radio programmes from quite a few countries in Europe, so it could be that they have no geographical restrictions at all. The default format for both TV and radio programmes is Flash, the FLV extension. You can set the tool to convert them to more portable formats on the fly as part of the download, but it slows things down. Unless you have a really fast connection, I'd always advise downloading them in their native format, which you do simply by including the raw, RAW, parameter in the command string. If you need to convert to another format to suit a particular device, just use a local tool afterwards. VLC and Parole are quite happy playing Flash audio and video, so I imagine that conversion to other formats is not really necessary for most people. Well, this completes two of my desktop. I do hope there's been something of use to somebody. Now, right at the beginning of this, I mentioned that my last HPR episode was encouraging people to try out some of the lesser-known applications, rather than just settling for the most popular. It may not have gone unnoticed that I still use a fair number of the most mainstream applications like LibreOffice, VLC and GIMP. The point is, I've arrived at the decision that they're the best for my requirements after trying quite a lot of other packages. So by adopting that approach, I've uncovered some real gems like MH Wave Edit, Gambus, Search Monkey and Decibel, which are now an essential part of my computing toolset. Others which I tried and rejected have subsequently come to my rescue later on when the mainstream applications let me down. Things like Parole and G-Scanned PDF. Well, that's it then. This is Beezer signing off for now. Thanks very much for listening.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.